Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Marseillaise playing as President Obama arrived in Paris this morning to talk with NATO leaders, or is the Marseillaise now the new global national anthem? After the results of the G20 summit and a little bit of a power shift that may be going on across the Atlantic, the G20 is over. Did it save the global economy? Did it revolutionize the international banking system? Did European capitalism stage a historic coup over the American kind? Or was a lot of tea consumed and iPods and hugs and faux pas dispensed without much real change? Let's get a view of the G20 from Felix Salmon. He writes the finance blog for Reuters.com. Hi, Felix. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
France was looking for a new global regulatory body over international banking rules. The United States resisted the idea of an international regulator. Did France get what it wanted?
Clearly not. No, the United States managed to block that one, but instead France managed to get language, or the G20 managed to create some language talking about how the IMF would be a sort of regulator of regulators, and it would make sure that the national regulators were doing their jobs. It's not nearly as strong as what France wanted, though.
As I understand it, the compromise was no official international regulatory body over the banks, but there will be new rules on tax havens and hedge funds and executive compensation that they pretty much all agreed to try to implement. Do you think that's the case?
Yes. The regulators, I mean, they've always wanted to work together. They've always made the right noises about trying to work in team with each other. But I think it's much more obvious now how necessary that is and how much they failed to do so over the past couple of decades. And so there is right now a move towards getting all of these national regulations in line with each other and everyone basically implementing those kind of regulations. Now, you know, the difficult thing is doing it, of course. It's very easy to say that you're going to do it. It's much more difficult to actually make sure that everyone does the same thing at the same time.
Can you give me an example, a concrete example, of how the rules in the United States were different than in the Western European nations? I mean, what we've heard is that the European banks were as over-leveraged as the big American banks when it came to, you know, what kind of loans to what kind of cash reserves they had on hand.
Well, there wasn't actually European regulation of that. One of the interesting things about Europe is that the UK banks were incredibly leveraged. If you look at Barclays, it was 60 to 1, which was much greater leverage than anything we saw in the US, even at places like Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. But on the other hand, if you look at the Spanish banks, the regulators in Spain were much tighter on capital adequacy ratios and leverage, and basically didn't let the local banks there take nearly as much risk on. Germany, for instance, was somewhere in the middle. So different national banking regulators had very different approaches to such things. In the U.S., you know, you could say it was similar to Germany, perhaps.
What about executive compensation? This was mentioned as a target for global rulemaking now. Are the governments all over the capitalist world going to tell all the companies how much they can pay their CEOs?
I think they're going to try. I'm not sure how well they're going to succeed. And I think in the first instance it's going to be very much directed at the companies which are receiving multi-billion dollar bailouts. I'm not sure there's going to be compensation caps across the board on all companies. Those are pretty much impossible to legislate. In any case, people always manage to find a way around them. But definitely, again, the new look U.S., the Obama administration, is perfectly happy to play along with European demands for such things. And that's a big change from where we've been for the past 8 years.
Listeners, you've been seeing and hearing and reading the coverage of the G20 over the last few days, President Obama's first big foray onto the international stage as president. What do you want to say about the G20? Open phones on the G20 or questions if you're trying to figure out what it means for Felix Salmon from Reuters. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. So, Felix, did some form of European capitalism triumph, or should say triomphe, over a form of American capitalism for some kind of new international system?
I think you can say that the laissez-faire ideology that we were part of, you know, the Bush administration very much pushed over the past 8 years is dead, and that the much more, that there's much more emphasis on regulation and making sure that governments keep an eye on things these days. Can you say that that's European style as opposed to American style? I think it's, you know, strong regulation as opposed to weak regulation. Some European countries, of course, are famous for having very little regulation. Look at Switzerland.
You know, the press is mixed, but a lot of what I've seen is rather up on the results of the summit this morning as accomplishing more than they expected. Did they accomplish more than you expected?
They did, actually. They certainly accomplished more on the international front. They managed to come up with a truly enormous amount of extra, genuinely additional money for the IMF, and that's going to help billions of people around the world, maybe not in the European Union, maybe not in the United States, but certainly in the rest of the world, which is being hit incredibly hard by this monster global recession. I mean, you know, in Asia, the export industry has just been crushed. And so if you take a global perspective here, the G20 has done a lot of good. And I think that's one of the great things about the G20 is because it does have members like Brazil and other countries which were always excluded from the G7 and G8 meetings, it has much more of a global perspective.
When you talk about exports from Asia being crushed, is that what the $1 trillion to fight protectionism is supposed to be about? You know, it does seem that about every other day we go on here and talk about a new pot of $1 trillion that's being spent on something or other, the banks and the this and the that. Now it's to stave off protectionism and help to guarantee trade. Who's going to spend this $1 trillion and who's going to get it?
Well, I think staving off protectionism is more of a policy thing. You can't force people to trade with each other when they when they're crushed again, there's that word again, under a recession. But what you can do is stop countries from putting up artificial trade barriers and tariffs and that kind of thing. So that's a political decision which is being made at the G20. The $1 trillion is mostly going to the IMF to support the accounts and the balance sheets of the countries which had been very much reliant on their export industries, and now with those exports down 50% in some cases, need some help to get through this crisis.
So if they're propping up the developing exporting countries, does that mean fewer jobs for American workers?
Not really. I mean, in general, American workers don't make the kind of things that the developing exporting countries make. The manufacturing industry in the U.S. tends to the more higher value-added end of things. And in any case, it's not obvious that if these developing countries weren't exporting stuff, then the Americans would be buying domestic instead. It there's not a simple sort of replacement thing going on there.
Yeah.
And more to the point, this money isn't going to suddenly get these countries exporting again. In fact, what it is to try and, in many cases, boost their internal demand so that they're much less reliant on exports and can really start selling domestically much more than they have done in the past.
All right, your calls on the G20 summit for Felix Salmon from Reuters. Jim in Queens, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Jim.
Hi. I'm a little confused because I thought that once when the U.S. selected Barack Obama, that Western Europe would be absolutely in love with us again. I mean, instead we're getting critical comments from Merkel. Sarkozy has been very critical of our stimulus policies. It's a guy who looked like he wanted to have Obama's baby in July when Obama went to Paris. What's going on? It's as if George Bush went to the G20 summit.
I can assure you that George Bush would have got a much less pleasant reception than the one that Barack Obama got.
But Jim asked an important question, I think, because pleasant reception is one thing. Did the Obama mystique matter to global policymakers and affect the outcome of this summit, or do they just like him better than Bush but then stick to their guns when it comes to British interests or German interests or French interests over U.S. interests, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, there's a couple of points to be made here. First of all, there's a weird sort of flip in terms of European opposition to the U.S. in that if you're looking at say, the fiscal stimulus, which Barack Obama wanted the Europeans to do more of, and the Europeans were very reluctant to do that, you can say that the Europeans were actually sort of attacking Obama from the right there. They were like, we don't want to spend more. You're the lefty who wants to spend more, and we don't want to go there.
Let me jump in on that point, because it's really funny to contrast the editorial on this in the New York Times and in the Wall Street Journal this morning after the G20. The Times is saying, oh, woe is us. Europe didn't allow the world to spend enough on stimulus to get people out of this slump. The Wall Street Journal editorial page is saying, thank God for the Europeans, and they never say that, right? But they're saying, thank God for European capitalism, because they weren't willing to dump needless money into stimulus packages. So which looking glass did we just pass through here?
Exactly. And the other thing, of course, is that Obama was a collegial mediator, negotiator. He was the star of the show. Everybody wanted to talk to him. He wanted to talk to everyone. And there was, I think, no way that the Bush administration could ever have achieved a G20 communique of this breadth and substance. Now, of course, there are always going to be disagreements. And on the regulatory front, as we spoke about earlier, the U.S. and the Europeans are still quite far apart. On the fiscal stimulus front, they're still quite far apart. So we're not all going to agree on everything all the time. But at least we're getting somewhere now, which feels just like a really refreshing change.
Phil in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Phil.
Yeah, hi. I'm a physical scientist, and I've noticed that for really decades, all the physical scientists who are not in the media loop have been pointing out that there's a physical world problem with continual multiplying money, free money, and it doesn't matter if it's a really nice guy promising it or really suspicious characters promising it.
In other words, there was a private sector capital bubble that burst, and we're trying to reinflate it as a government bubble.
Well, yeah, the promise too good to be true of doubling our use of the Earth without any impact. And because that's clearly the source of all our impact, and we just have not been very self-critical, it seems.
Are we in the same conversation, Phil? Are you talking about the G20 Economic Summit?
Yeah, the G20 Economic Summit said dozens of times we need to return to continual economic growth. And that means continual doubling. I don't know if people know the math, but it when you add percents, it means multiplying scale over time.
Right. And actually, Felix Salmon from Reuters, Phil makes a very important, even larger point probably than anything they were really discussing at the G20 summit, which is if you're going to bank on perpetual economic growth, if the point of letting China and India and other emerging nations try to get to U.S.-style standards of living, is that at cross purposes with what everybody is saying about needing to slow down our emission of carbon, or we're going to destroy the Earth?
Absolutely. You can't. It's going to be incredibly difficult to get China to U.S. standards of living without massively increasing our carbon emissions. And the G20 summit, while it did make a few hand-wavy gestures in the direction of being green, really didn't bite that particular bullet. So that's a massive problem which is going to face the planet over the coming decades. And you can kind of forgive the G20 for concentrating on slightly more immediate crises this particular meeting.
They will have the global warming summit at another time. I want to play a clip of President Obama at the G20 and ask you, did this president lead, follow, or get out of the way meeting with these other leaders?
When I came here, it was with the intention of listening and learning, but also providing American leadership. And I think that the document that has been produced, as well as the concrete actions that will follow, reflect a range of our priorities.
Now, Felix Salmon from Reuters, is that a historic clip? Is that the President of the United States kind of accepting a downgraded leadership role in the world from what the United States has purported to be about in the past?
I think it's the United States trying to lead in a collegial way. It's the United States trying to say, hey, we're one big important country, but there are lots of other important countries as well, and let's try and get together and let's listen to what you want, and let's try and put on the table what we want and come to some kind of agreement and do something constructive. And that is a new way of doing things rather than the more unilateral approach that was taken in the past. So it's a different approach. I don't know if it means that the U.S. is losing its leadership position. In many ways, it's gaining a leadership position in terms of what it's able to achieve on the international stage.
What role did China play at this summit? Beforehand, it expressed concern about its $1 trillion, there's that number again, of U.S. debt holdings, and suggested a new international currency to replace the dollar. What about once they actually got to London?
China was clearly important because it was responsible for, as you say, that $1 trillion of capital flows into the United States, which you can ultimately, if you take the very big picture, trace a straight line from that capital, and then it all came into America, and we didn't know what to do with it, and so we inflated the housing bubble with it. I mean, you can blame China for the housing bubble. It's not very easy, but it can be done.
European papers today are talking about a G2, the U.S. and China. Have you seen any of that?
Yeah, and it's true that because the European countries aren't actually changing very much in terms of their budgets and their national finances, the two biggest stimulus packages in the planet are the China's and America's. And so as a result, it's China and the U.S. which are really making the marginal difference here. Europe is fiddling around with regulation, and that's going to be important going forward to prevent another crisis. But in terms of resolving the present crisis, it's the U.S. and China which are really pushing the envelope.
Before you go, the British press was also abuzz about a collection of little faux pas by the Obamas. He referred to England rather than the U.K. I guess they didn't like that in Scotland and Wales. And was an iPod an appropriate gift for the Queen? And Michelle Obama apparently broke all the rules unwittingly, I didn't know this rule, by giving the Queen a hug. Imagine.
Shocking, isn't it? Absolutely. How dare she?
What's the hug rule? Is it some kind of no-touching caste system?
Something like that. It's one of those bizarre monarchistic anachronisms that the Brits do love for reasons I don't understand. I think, at least according to the New York Times today, which is frankly all I know about this, it's something to do with the idea that it dates back to when you had the divine right of kings, and kings of England were supposed to be blessed by God, and that you could kings could supposedly cure scrofula just by touching people. And so the royal touch was a very valuable thing, and you don't just go ahead and touch someone without their special dispensation. But yeah, it's ridiculous.
And equally scandalous, said the press, the Queen hugged her back. Maybe the no-touch rule has left Her Majesty a little starved for affection.
Maybe it has, yes.
We leave it there at the end of the G20 summit with Felix Salmon, who writes about the economy for Reuters.com. Felix, thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.